playing it very loose. And I know that you're going to get one of the most exciting lectures you've ever had. But and also there will be a discussion period afterwards, if you wish. If you're bored, forget it. And I don't think I need to run through the publicity releases on this, but suffice it to know that Mr. Layton has published 16 volumes of poetry, and his, as Dr. Hoburg said the other day, he outsold the novels of the time, and this all goes to prove that a poet is not necessarily bad because he's popular. I could go into Joyce Kilmer and the various variations on it, but I will not. But to briefly summarize Mr. Layton's creed, I hope, I will read from the foreword from the Red Carpet 2, 4, 4, 4, 4, Red Carpet 4, The Sun. I see my work as an effort to achieve a definition of independence. However, I have in my share in the common disgrace, you get this common disgrace, this is important, project along with others the fearful rigidities, crippling and conformiting of family, state, and religion. This is hard to take, but this is the way it is with an independent poet. And those of you who know Blake have no problems here. So we meet the true marriage of heaven and hell, as John Ciardi called him in the Saturday Review, and we meet really what I hope will be a steam boiler, as he has been called.
Thank you very much, Dr. Corrales, for your warm and, I hope, not misleading introduction.
I read your words.
Yes, you read my own words, so it can't be misleading. I want to thank St. Lawrence University for the very warm welcome that it has extended to both myself and my wife. We have enjoyed the hospitality, and I hope that we will still be friends at the end of my address. I feel very privileged, indeed, to take part in your festival. If there's one beef that Canadians have and sometimes express, it is that their very large American neighbors are sometimes unmindful of their existence. Thus, there was an article on poetry in last week's Time magazine. It was an article on English-speaking poetry, and there was no reference at all to Canadian poetry. Now, those back in Canada who write poetry felt somewhat neglected in view of the fact that they believe that the best poetry that has been written since the war has been written in Canada. And we felt that perhaps the writer of the article would not have been so pessimistic about the results of poetry writing in the past 15 or 17 years if he had cast his eyes on what has been taking place across the border. I know it is customary for an out-of-town speaker to say something about the architecture that he has seen. It shows that he's got an observant eye, that he's sophisticated, but he's noted everything very carefully and so on. Well, I shan't do that, beyond saying that the architecture that I've noticed on this campus displays a very fine eclecticism. And that no style of architecture has been unduly favored over another. You may not, or you may know, that the most important event in Canadian history was your own American Revolution. For this reason, that it sent the, shall we say, reactionaries or conservatives, the so-called loyalists, scurrying across the border. And this has had a determining effect on Canadian history, on Canadian politics, on Canadian culture. It has given, I regret to say, a slight anti-American bias to Canadians. It is not, as some lady told me last night, that Canadians are envious of the affluency of Americans, that they are resentful and don't like Americans. That is not so. While we're not as affluent as the Americans, nevertheless, we also enjoy a degree of affluency. So it isn't that. It does stem from this rather conservative, loyalist element, mixed up with other things, that has given to Canadians a slight anti-American prejudice. Despite this, it is true to say that Canadians are Americans dragging their feet. What we are worried about in Canada is your size, your power, not your wealth. We don't envy that. But sometimes Canadians have a difficulty in deciding who's running their country, whether it's our prime minister or your president. Certainly, whenever your president sneezes, our prime minister has a cold. For all that, the differences between Americans and Canadians are quite shallow. And they're not half as important as the things that we have in common. I'm not going to go into long taradiddle about our common Anglo-Saxon background and tradition and so on. I'm going to point to more depressing things, because these things are really the substance of what I want to talk about today. As you know, I'm going to talk about Prince Hamlet and the Beatniks. I don't want you to think of this moment. Now, we know that Hamlet was mad. Is Leighton mad also? What connection can there possibly be between the royal courtier, Prince Hamlet, and the Beatniks? But I'm going to try and show this afternoon that there is an important connection between them, and that, in a sense, Prince Hamlet, the Beatniks, and all writers confront the same sort of problem, although they may give different answers to that problem. I was saying that our differences are shallow, and the things that we have in common are not. And that these things appear to be, on the surface anyhow, depressing and sometimes very terrifying. To a writer, what impresses him when he crosses the border, when he goes back and forth, whether it's the American writer coming to Canada or the Canadian writer going to the United States, what strikes him immediately is that you have the same middle-class civilization, the same middle-class values. The bitch goddess success is worshipped as reverently here as in my own country. And there's the same mad, wild, terrifying pursuit of the status symbols of the large car, the two-car garage, the split-level bungalow, and shall I say, the split-level thinking that often goes with a split-level bungalow. It is a similar technological society with mass-produced ugliness on every side. Little attention, if any, is paid to the needs of architectural beauty, or spiritual beauty, or aesthetic beauty, any kind of beauty. The real estater seems to be the final determiner of what the aesthetic values in the community will be. There is here, as in Canada, the same concern with gadgets. The sick jokes have appeared. There's the organization man, correct, unimpassioned, unimaginative, wearing his collar with a certain degree of pride and certainly with much self-assurance. And Reisman, in talking about the lonely crowd, is, I feel, describing not only the lonely crowds of New York, Chicago, Detroit, but also of Montreal and Toronto. The terrible loneliness of the individual seeking some kind of comfort, some kind of security in the excitement of the crowd. The mass-produced, pain-haunted faces that one finds on the buses, on the highways, in the restaurants. Of course, Canadians, like Americans, have also begun to worry about their weight. Here, as there, there's an anti-intellectual society. The values of the mind are of little importance. And the intellectual, whether as writer, or scientist, or philosopher, whether as poet or playwright, finds himself alienated from a community which appears to have no respect for the things of the mind. This produces a division, a tragic division, I feel, between the writer and the society which he is prepared to serve, but only on his own proud, integral terms. And in Canada, as here, I notice the same dichotomy between materialism and idealism. The same piety and push. The same high-minded gab and low-minded grab. Lip service paid to the greatest values, the highest values, but the conduct, the behavior, so frequently, so often falling short of the high ideals, the noble goals that both Canadians and Americans seem to put before them. In Canada, as here, it is the press agent that is honored, not the poet. The press agent who can create images and feels that he is on a par with the poet because he can create these images that will sell the product. The chrome-colored bathroom paper, the soaps, the toothpastes. The press agent, your copywriter, regards himself as a glorified poet. The only difference being that he earns more for his images than the poet does, and that appears to give him the right to look down upon the poet constructing his images. Have I given an unfair picture of American society? Is this some distorted nightmare that I have projected? If so, I can only blame the American writers themselves. For many years, I taught newcomers in Montreal, people that came from Poland, Russia, Germany, Yugoslavia. And when I got them to talk about America, their picture of America, I found, was made up largely, in fact, entirely from their readings. Whom had they been reading? Your American writers. Theodore Dreiser's An American Tragedy, the terrible, I don't mean this in a disparaging literary sense, the terrible tragedies of Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, King Cole, Oil, Boston, dealing with the horrible facts of exploitation in this country. Sinclair Lewis, with a picture of babbitry and philistinism, Main Street, Aerosmith. The American writers seem to revel in this picture. And what is it that they present? They present a society that is violent, corrupt, evil, and exploitative, where there is no longer any humanity, any decency, any kindness, or fellowship. And those who have not had the opportunity of crossing the border, as I frequently have, and seeing for myself how very fine, how very amiable, how very generous, how very hospitable Americans are, might indeed feel that this is the entire, the complete story of American civilization. Or what shall we make of a Norman Mailer, one of your most talented writers, who recently visited Montreal, my city? He spoke at McGill. A very large crowd turned out to hear him, listened to him most attentively. We feel that Norman Mailer is an important writer, a significant American writer. And what is it that he told us about his country? He said, "Americans were a frightened people." I'm quoting him. "Americans are a frightened people. They do not," he says, "dare to speak out. They have become conformists, either out of fear or policy or simple ignorance and the pressures of their civilization that work so dreadfully upon them." What is the answer to all this? Go underground, young man, go underground. No longer Horace Greeley's proud and confident assertion, "Go west, young man, go west. There's a world to conquer," but go underground. And he didn't mean a bomb shelter, you know. He just meant that any individual in the United States who possesses sensitivity, imagination, who's still a human being, has no choice but to go underground if he wishes to preserve these qualities. And what is Salinger saying in his stories, story after story? The same thing. He is saying there's no place for the sensitive individual in the brutal, callous, unfeeling society that Americans have created in the 20th century. A short story, to my mind, a genuine minor classic for Esme with Love and Squalor, presents us with an individual who is sensitive, who can talk to a young girl, and incidentally, for Salinger, it is only the young who are still uncorrupted. And then there is the war, and he becomes a shell-shocked victim. And the war becomes the symbol, the focal point of all the destructive forces of society, let loose, according to Salinger's imagination, by the baboons and the apes that create this world. So on the one hand, for Norman Mailer, for Tennessee Williams, for Salinger, you have the thoughtless many creating a brutal civilization without any regard for human values, and on the other, you have the sensitive outsider who can no longer fit in to this society and must study the various strategies for preserving himself. For Norman Mailer, it is go underground. For Salinger, it is create an imaginary world of your own. Never mind the others. You live in this world that you have created, and if you can find one or two others who can share this happy construction with you, fine, so much the better. And it may be absurd, and it may be insane, and it may be altogether fantastic and have no relevancy to reality, well, that's fine. That's precisely its best recommendation. Live in that world. Seeing this phenomenon, I asked myself, what is the possible explanation for this? If you look at other literatures, Canadian, or English, or French, or Russian, or German, you will find occasional criticism by the writers, and after all, it is the writer's job to criticize. It's not your politician who's going to do that with his patriotic 4th of July speech. It isn't the school principal who's going to do that. That's not their job, but it is the writer's job to criticize. And so, other writers of other countries have criticized. But there's never been quite that consistent volume of abuse and vehemence in that criticism. This is a litany of insults, which comes, if I may mix metaphors, from the pen of the American writer. What is the explanation for this? I can only say that for me, the reasonable explanation goes something like this. No country has been founded with the degree of moral idealism that your country was founded. It was dedicated from the outset to the realization of a certain dream: equality, democracy, fraternity, freedom. Read the debates of the founding fathers. Read the utterances of your statesmen, whether Webster or Lincoln or Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson. There's always this high call to a moral purpose. There's no other country that exhibits anything like this, you see? Consequently, the American writer, who is, perhaps rightly so, the most sensitive in the community, looking at the abstract ideal and the concrete reality, is offended and startled by the contrast, and loses, perhaps, a necessary perspective on his own people, because he is judging his own people as only God has the right to judge them, from the standpoint of an abstract justice, an abstract truth, an abstract goodness. The only other people that I could put beside the Americans would be the Jews, who for many years regarded themselves, and many still do, as the chosen people. And therefore, when the Jews, the Israelites or the Hebrews backslide, there are the prophets thundering at them and saying, look, you have done so and so. You have worshipped idols. You have been greedy. You have been materialistic. Therefore, God will punish you. And there is wrath and thunder and indignation. Well, in a sense, the Americans are the chosen people today. Whether they have been chosen by an almighty power or by history, or they have chosen it themselves, the fact remains that from George Washington down to President Kennedy, there is the same high call to noble acts and noble thoughts. So the beatniks arrive upon the scene. And they are antisocial. They are nihilistic. They have a hatred and mistrust of culture. They are cynics, and I'm using the word in the old sense. The word cynic, as you probably know, is derived from the Greek word kine, meaning a dog. The early cynics, the followers of Diogenes, dressed poorly, exhibited the most deplorable manners, behaved, in short, doggishly, and so they got the name of dogs. What was Diogenes getting at? Diogenes was getting at what he believed to be the faults of his civilization. For civilization carries with it hypocrisies, exploitation, injustice, inequality, materialism, arrogance, pride of wealth, and so on. So, at a certain point, whether it is Diogenes or Rousseau or Allen Ginsberg today, they step off and say, we don't want any of this at all. We prefer to go naked, to strip ourselves, to exhibit disgusting and filthy habits and clothes, rather than dress ourselves in the vestments of wealth and hypocrisy. When this anti-culture streak becomes really strong, vehement, then there's the praise of the illiterate, the dispraise of anyone who appears to have been trapped by the status symbols, and so the word square is coined. Anyone who holds down a job, dresses decently, raises a family, does ordinary things, is called immediately a square by the beats. So you have this division in contemporary society of squares versus beats. And the beats feel quite sure that they are right, that the squares have been trapped by a hideously mechanical, dehumanized, materialistic civilization. They are also, if I may coin the word, malapergiorists. They are ones who say things are bad and they are bound to get worse. They turn their backs on reform or on the hope and possibility of reform. What is the significance of the Beat movement? For one thing, it is an authentic protest movement in the great tradition of the American protest movements. What are they protesting against? They are protesting against the spiritual impoverishment in an affluent society. They are protesting against the lack of true fellowship. They are protesting against the prevailing materialism and selfishness which they see all about them. They are protesting against this fact that the only value that appears to operate in American society is survival. That the only thing that Americans are concerned about is surviving the next world war. And that the great debate that is going on is whether, if someone has built a bomb shelter, he's entitled to fit it out with rifles and guns and shoot down his neighbor who might want to come in for shelter. A hideous picture, an exaggerated picture, but the beatniks think that exaggerated and hideous as that picture might be, it is nevertheless the truth about the American people at the present time. And yet, I derive hope from these beatniks, where others see in them nothing but a disgusting, noisy, un-American movement. I derive hope from them because when you examine their writings, the writings of Corso, Ferlinghetti, Allen Ginsberg, Kerouac, you notice something very odd. You notice that they espouse the ideals and values of American society, of American civilization. They're talking all the time about fellowship, love, but love is their big word, Zen Buddhism. They seem to have a religious attitude towards the materialistic facts of contemporary American society. And as I say, I find this very hopeful, because it means that these things, these values, are still very much alive. Compare this underground movement, I say, with the underground literary movement in Germany after the First World War. And there is an interesting difference to observe. Because the writers that appeared in Germany after the First World War, the underground, the followers of the poet Stephen George, put forward different values. totalitarian, authoritarian values, aristocratic values, values preaching the supremacy of one group over another group. And this underground is very interesting as a reflection of the society, because on the surface you had the Weimar Republic, liberal and democratic. But the real forces that had gone underground and were reflected by the German writers were the forces that were to shape the Germany of Hitler and Goebbels and Goering, Nazi Germany. It means then, to my mind, that as long as there are beat poets, the ideals and values of American society are not dead. It means that they are a lost generation. And you have a lost generation always as a reaction to an overdose of moral idealism. The lost generation of the 20s was surely a response to the moral idealism of the First World War. This was a war to end all wars, a war to produce a world for heroes, a world safe for democracy, and all the other propaganda that sent the young men into the trenches to slaughter one another. Then the profound disillusionment and cynicism of the post-war years and Hemingway and Fitzgerald and the other writers that were influential in the 20s, a lost generation. Or take the lost generation that has now appeared in Russia, and for the same reason. The moral idealism of the Stalin years, the propaganda that were building a classless society, brotherhood, fellowship, and so on. And now Khrushchev comes out and tells the Russian people the hideous truth that here was a megalomaniac, that there was injustice, arbitrary imprisonment, cruelty, torture, exile for anyone who dared to stand up to the dictator. The unpleasant facts told to the people after this moral propaganda. And so you have a lost generation appearing in Russia, bewildered, cynical, distrusting all values, and saying they are not real, not real, that they can never be real. And in a sense, the beats are a lost generation as against not only 4 years or 15 years of moral propaganda, but 150 years of moral propaganda. And they are, in effect, calling upon the Americans to live up to the ideals of the founding fathers and of the presidents and vice presidents who have spoken nobly and rhetorically from time to time. Yet for all that, the beats, I feel, are too frightened, much too hysterical, too passive. They have given up the fight to produce the good society, or to even think about it. And this, I think, is their fatal weakness and their fatal limitation as writers. They may, like the nihilists of Tsarist Russia, hurl great changes in American society. I think that they are a significant phenomenon. They may not leave any great masterpieces behind, like the Ode to the Grecian Urn or Tennyson's Ulysses, but I think that they have called attention to certain defects in both your society and my own society, and that we will neglect them only to our own cost. So where does Hamlet come into all this? What relation, what connection, if any, can he possibly have with the beatniks? Well, I think I can make it a fairly good case that Hamlet is a beat. He's a beat poet. Like the beats, he lives in a corrupt society. Like the beats, Hamlet is antisocial, bitter, insulting, and bad-mannered. Like the beats, Hamlet uses his knowledge of moral corruption to make himself disagreeable. This is an interesting, I think, psychological insight. I think the beats have gotten a hold of this. I hope you can follow me in this explanation. This is their weakness. This is their great temptation. This, I think, is their great undoing. You have a person, perhaps you yourselves have been guilty of it at times. I know I have. You have a person who knows that the society around him is corrupt. They are all evil and hypocritical and so on. And he knows it. And that gives him a certain psychological advantage. And therefore he can say, well, I know that you're corrupt, therefore I can behave as disgustingly as I want. You see what I mean? It's a kind of an offense, a kind of an affront. It's a kind of getting back. It's an aggressiveness disguised as moral righteousness. And this is what the beats have done, and this is what Hamlet did. Hamlet knew that he was superior to the corrupt society in which he lived. There was Polonius, a time server. There was the king upon the throne who had assassinated his own brother. And there was his own mother who had had an adulterous relation and was living with this murderer. And you have Guildenstern and Rosencrantz, also time servers. And the whole of that society is evil and corrupt. Only those who can push, connive, will get to the top. Those who can flatter the king and serve him will get to the top. A decadent, corrupt society. And Hamlet is enjoined to do something which he finds disagreeable. To revenge his dead father. His words are interesting. When the ghost tells him, you must take revenge, Hamlet says, that I will do with wings swift as meditation or the thoughts of love and sweep to my revenge. Isn't that odd? That I, with wings swift as meditation or the thoughts of love, may sweep to my revenge. Isn't that an odd way of saying, I'm going to take revenge? And look at the images. I will do it with wings swift as meditation or the thoughts of love. Intellect and love, what have they to do with this disagreeable task that has been foisted upon him? And then, when the ghost has acquainted him with the full measure of the uncle's crime, he says, meet it be that I put down in my tablets that a man may smile and smile and smile and be a damned villain, and proceeds to write it down in his tablets. He is a poet. He is a poet who would rather have love and meditation, who would have a proper society, not live in a corrupt society. The tragedy of Hamlet is the tragedy of the good man living in an evil and corrupt society. It is therefore heartbrokenly that he says, the time is out of joint, O cursed spite, that I was born to set it right. This is his problem. He would rather meditate. He would rather love Ophelia. He would rather write poems than do the things that are necessary in order to survive in a corrupt society. It is this that makes him bitter, cynical, disillusioned, with a lacerating cynicism, a self-cynicism. It is this that paralyzes him, for he is enjoined to do something which he finds most disagreeable. Even as a writer today will find it disagreeable to engage in the polemics of the Cold War or worry about the possible annihilation of 100 million people. I think of your idealist Stevenson, who strikes me as being a sort of Hamlet character, who must perforce engage in politics, even though he would far rather do something more interesting and more creative than politics. And this is Hamlet. Hamlet, bitterly knowing that he has been asked to do something disagreeable, contemptible, only because this is a disagreeable and contemptible society, and there's no way out of the involvement in that dialectics. And so he hates himself. Even as Marcello in La Dolce Vita hates himself, because he has greater self-awareness, greater self-insight than the other decadent characters in the film. And out of this self-hatred, like the beets, he creates the disgusting habits, the intolerance, the coldness with which, for example, he sees the course of Polonius, or the way he condemns Guildenstern and Rosencrantz to death, callously, coldly. It is a self-lacerating cynicism and bitterness. Yet he is not a beat, though he exhibits some of the characteristic of the beats, and for the reasons which I've tried to put forward. For the fact remains that Hamlet accepts the injunction to act, though he may be unable to act. He accepts it. He does not retire. He does not, with Mahler, go underground, or with Salinger, into some fantastic world of his own creation. The tragedy, the heartbreaking tragedy of Hamlet, surely, is that he wrestles with this insoluble problem to the very end. He will not soil himself by a cold-blooded murder of his uncle. Plainly, he is unable to do that. When he finds his uncle kneeling at the altar, and he could stab him with his poniard, he does not do it. He gives himself some excuse such as, well, if I stab him now while he's praying, he'll go straight up to heaven. And he, when he murdered my father, he says, was full of bread, and therefore he went straight to Hades or purgatory. But anybody can see this is only a rationalization for his refusal to act. To do anything. He plainly finds the injunction distasteful. Possibly a revolution is what he has in mind. I find that the commentators have singularly ignored this possibility. They have, I think, perhaps been obsessed with the idea that the revenge must be of the cloak and dagger kind. You see? Hamlet stabbing the dagger into the chest or the back of the guilty king. But supposing that was not Hamlet's idea at all, perhaps he thought that he might get the people on his side, and several times Shakespeare tells us that Hamlet was popular with the mass of people. They love him, this side of adulation, reverence. And the fact that Laertes comes in at the end, Laertes the playboy comes in at the end storming the palace, and the throne of Denmark appears to be tottering. If Laertes could do it, Shakespeare seems to be saying, why not Hamlet, who is better beloved than Laertes and has the same sort of motive as Laertes? I throw this out as a possibility that commentators on the play have not sufficiently explored. But the fact remains that the poet in Hamlet questions, doubts, stands aside, anatomizes. He would rather contemplate than act. So would any poet. So would any creator. This is the insoluble problem for the writer. These are the two poles for any writer, the thought and the deed. And Shakespeare, I feel, has presented us the classic portrait of the poet who would far rather contemplate the deed than perform the deed. What does the poet care for honor? What does he really care for revenge? What does he care for a Fortinbras? He looks at Fortinbras and he says, look at this man, and look at the soldiers. They are ready to seek, what is it? Reputation at the very mouth of the cannon. And for what? For a piece of ground. And then he says, let henceforth all my thoughts be bloody. But he cannot make his thoughts bloody. A Fortinbras can. An Alexander can. A Caesar can. But not a poet. You see? These things don't mean anything to the poet. Honor? Revenge? They mean nothing to him. Meditation? Love? Fellowship, creativity, these are the things that are important to the poet, to the writer, that are important to Hamlet. And so throughout, Hamlet is pulled between these two poles of poetry and action. He is the good man in an evil society, even though he has taken on some of the evil characteristics of that corrupt society and has become lacerated by them. At the end, it seems to me, Hamlet finally accepts his inability to act. Notice the graciousness of Hamlet at the end, to his mother, to Laertes, the great reconciliation scene where he says, I was mad. When I did this and this, I was mad. You cannot really blame me. There's such a graciousness, such a humility in Hamlet at the end, and even his rejoinders to the king. This is a poet Hamlet who knows. He is not cut out to be a Castro or a Meiotse Tung. You see, Meiotse Tung was a poet. Castro writes verse, but they can also turn their minds and thoughts to bloody deeds and actions. But not Hamlet. He is the true poet, the true writer who knows that he has no capacity for this sort of thing. But in this play, Shakespeare has shown for all time the dialectic that goes on in the true artist's mind. The dialectic of thought and action. That the writer cannot escape the obligations to think about the evil and corrupt society in which he lives. Like the Hebrew prophets, he has to storm against them. He cannot go underground. He cannot exhibit cowardice. He may not retreat. He must constantly attempt to enlighten his fellow men, his contemporaries, point out to them the defects of their society, and never discourage them by saying, the situation is well nigh hopeless. There's nothing you can do about it. Human beings are so evil, so corrupt, that there is no hope of recovery for them. This is the difference between a Hamlet and a Ginsberg. Or let's put it another way, in a symbolic way that you can see very clearly.